essentially, you know, these are all the big, pretty nebula that you see in all these photos. So like the North America, the Pelican, you know, Orion Nebula, Horsehead, on and on and on. Rosette, you know, all the ones that are super famous that you see. Those are going to be, most of which are going to be the emission nebula. And these are the ones that you have the advantage of using these types of filters because they're looking specifically for hydrogen, oxygen, and sulfur. You can basically cheat by putting that filter in and cutting out all the streetlights and things that aren't putting off those exact wavelengths, but the nebulae behind them are.
Astronomical filters can go a long way to improving your enjoyment of both observing and imaging in amateur astronomy. In this episode, Dustin and I are going to dive in and teach you all about the kinds of filters that are out there, how they work, and whether or not you think you might need one. Astronomical filters on this episode of Space Junk Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. Hello, space fans. Welcome back to another episode of Space Junk Podcast. I'm with my good friend Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes. And today, we're as promised, we're going to talk about telescope filters. There's lots to know about this topic. There is a great many filters out there. But what are they good for? And when should you start looking at maybe getting a filter for your imaging or visual rig? We're going to talk about all that in this episode because we love filters. How you doing, Dustin?
Good, good. It's good to be doing another one of these. We've covered this a little bit in other podcasts, but it's still one of the questions that always comes up, especially for people doing imaging. Not as much with visual, although I do get a lot of questions related to visual, usually people trying to use their imaging filters for visual and not understanding the difference or why it may or may not work. So we'll just dig into all of it. We'll start at the beginning and go through what filters are and which ones make the most sense for different applications.
Yeah, it can be as in-depth as we want as far as technicalities go, but on a basic level, a filter, as you kind of intuitively can imagine, is a way of selecting which light it lets through. All photons throughout the electromagnetic spectrum come at us at a variety of wavelengths. It's either the wavelength is a characteristic of the light that you're seeing, which is inversely proportional to its frequency. All of those things are related to each other by the speed of light. The frequency and the wavelength is if you multiply those two together, you should get the speed of light. That's how they're related. But we don't want to see all light coming at us all the time in all situations. So, for example, our eyes are kind of a filter all by themselves. They are tuned to be able to see easiest the green wavelengths, but we can see all the way out to red colors and all the way out to blue colors. So it's kind of a wide band filter, your eye itself. We can't see things in the infrared. We can't see things in the ultraviolet. Our eyes kind of selective. They've sort of evolved over the years, over the millennia, over the entire course of human history to be able to see the wavelengths it does see. So that's kind of a basic filter right there. But in astronomy, there are filters that even go narrower. They only let you see even less light that comes at us from the sky. And we want to do that for a variety of reasons. It depends on what you're doing. But filters are characterized primarily by two things. The wavelengths that they allow through, which photons do they let go through, and what's the band pass, or what's the width of the frequency or the wavelength ranges that it will let through? The better the filter, the narrower this wavelength range is. So they're just generally very expensive, for example, to make a very narrow band filter, a filter that only lets a small range of wavelengths through, and it's less expensive to make one that's wider. And they can be, there can be many different types of which we'll go over here in this podcast. But the thing to remember about filters is they block light out almost, they'd only let a certain wavelength through. Let me say it that way. They only let a certain range of photons through depending on how they're built. And the, whether you have a visual filter or a imaging filter will also determine what kind of filter you get. For example, things that are good for visual imaging are filters that cut out unwanted glare, stray light. If you're looking at something bright, you might want to put a polarizer in there, which will only let polarized light through. That's how your sunglasses work. That does a lot to cut down on glare because you don't get all those crazy photons that are going in all different directions, or that are vibrating in all kinds of different directions, just the ones that are polarized. And that's good for seeing light that's reflected, like off of the moon, or also cutting down sky brightness and light pollution. So a visual filter might help you do that, but no matter what, it's going to be dimmer than if you did not have a filter. However, the contrast will be higher. The details that you can see will be a little bit better. So a visual filter helps you, especially with bright things, like say the Orion Nebula or the moon, planets, you know, all of this stuff that cuts out light, like a light pollution filter would try to cut out a lot of the glare that's associated with sky reflections and things like that from ambient light. Whereas a polarizer will enhance contrast. So you can see only those, that polarized light that's reflected off of a surface. Any light that reflects off of something else, whether it's the water, whether it's the moon, whether it's a tree, the light that comes at you from that reflected surface is polarized. It's the nature of reflected light. So anything that's reflected, you want to have a polarizer on if you want to see more contrast, if it's very bright. It'll cut down a lot of glare. Imaging, and this is something Dustin can talk about ad nauseum, is the is a different kind of filter, much narrower bands and for a variety of specialized uses. And we'll go into that in just a minute. But that's basically what a filter does, is it selects which frequency ranges or wavelengths of light that reaches either your eye or your sensor. How's that?
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation. Dustin
goes before we start the video, before we start this episode, I'm going to, you talk about what filters are. And so I go into this explain mode. So it may have
been. Well, no, it's good. It's good because I really think that's the right starting point. I mean, you even took it to the electromagnetic spectrum, which I think is the right place to start because when you're in astronomy, you end up thinking about it all the time and you realize like visible light is just this tiny piece, this very, very tiny piece of the whole EM spectrum, you know, starting with gamma rays all the way to radio waves. But you can't see that stuff. You can't see X-rays. You can't see even UV or IR, which are just outside of visible light. But some animals can. Some animals can see deeper into red than we can. They can start to see into the IR and see those heat signatures and things like that. And so it's not a function of just like this exists and it only exists to living beings. Living beings can only see these colors. That's not true. I mean, some animals can see less color than we can and some can see more. Or just different. They can see deeper into specific colors like red. But what filters do is
dogs can only see grayscale. I don't know if that's true, but I just heard that somewhere. But that would be that would just mean they didn't have color receptors in their eyeballs. But yeah, I was talking. Yeah, human eyes can only see a certain range of frequencies.
Yeah, and I don't know the specific animal. I think rattlesnakes are an example of animals that can see deeper into IR than humans can. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, filters will allow you to take, you know, and it's not only here, but in the visible spectrum is where we use it most. And so you look at it and it's like, well, I only want to isolate red. That's what a filter allows you to do. The filter is going to block out all of the green, all of the blue and everything in between and allow just red to pass through. When I first got started, I had never thought about any of this stuff because I didn't have a reason to. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not something that's covered, or at least where I went to school, it wasn't covered in the science classes. We never really talked about these things. And so I had no idea what filters did. And my assumption was backwards. It was that a filter for red, like a red filter, is going to pull red light in, which might amplify the red signal. And that's not true. What it's doing is it's allowing red light to pass through with whatever the transmission value of those coatings is. So if it's 95%, it's allowing 95% of that red light through. But it's not going to go out and get 150% of the red light or anything like that. It's not going to amplify the signal. It's just keeping out the other things so that you can isolate the signal. And when you think about it that way, a lot of the other issues that come up, especially filters for visual, the visual aspects of the hobby, make a lot more sense on why they're a little bit problematic. You know, when gathering light isn't as simple as just doing a long exposure. So, yeah, I think the EM spectrum was a great place to start. And I thought your explanation of filters in general was really good. But let's talk about, you know, specifically the filters that people use. Do you use filters at all, Tony, for your visual observing?
Only when I'm doing the moon or planets. I like having a polarizer, and I like having what they call them, light pollution filters, but they do help cut down a lot of the extraneous wavelengths.
It makes the sky darker. And you're fortunate in that, you know, especially when you're talking about bright objects, planets, the moon, and your telescope being a half meter telescope, you have a lot of extra light. When you're looking at the moon, that's a lot of extra light. It's actually painful to look through your telescope at a full moon. It's just so much light that you can cut down, you know, probably half the light or more and have a better experience, get a better view of the moon because it's going to be easier for your eye to handle. But some telescopes, that's not the case. And so it really depends on the telescope that you have and how much light gathering power capability, you know, it has. And, you know, how much you're willing to cut out. But I see a lot of people trying to use, like, for instance, the extreme example would be people that buy the Triad Ultra filter. This is a true narrowband multi-channel filter, but these are like 3 to 4 nanometer wavelengths, really, really small. I mean, we're talking less than 1/1000th of a human hair width, right? Like really, really small wavelengths, isolated. And then they put this filter over, you know, their visual telescope. They put it before the eyepiece so that the light they're getting, they're like, well, how come I can't see like what my camera can see? And anytime you're using narrowband filters, especially when they're down to 3 and 4 and even 5 nanometers, you know, your exposure times go way up with the camera. If normally you're doing, you know, exposure times without a filter of, let's say, 10 seconds or 5 seconds, it's going to be a multiple of that when you're cutting out 99% of the light. And so cutting out 99% of the light visually, the problem is you can't change the exposure time of the human eye. And so what you get is what you get. And if your signal was already reduced because instead of a 5 second or a 10 second exposure, it was 1/60th of a second for the human eye, which is pretty standard, then, you know, it's like, well, now you're going to cut out 99% of that. You're not going to see anything at all. It's just going to be a black image and there's nothing you can do about it except go to a telescope the size of a skyscraper to try to get more light to make that pass through, you know? And so that's the issue. And you really have to be careful which filters you get. Don't think that you can go out and buy a filter for imaging where you have the advantage of exposure time, you know, manipulation and use the same filter for visual where the human eye just doesn't have the capabilities of the camera to be manipulated in that way. It's not going to work.
Yeah, they're just not compatible. Almost all filters in astronomy are called interference filters, which means that the way that you get the wavelength that you want out of it is it reflects all of the wavelengths that it doesn't want and only allows those that it does want through. But it gets rid of those wavelengths by something called interference. It has different layers, they're called dielectric layers in it, that each reflects a certain wavelength of light. And you stack those layers up and they interfere with each other, causing that light to not be passed through the filter. How many layers do you put in and how the quality of the optics and the coatings that you use will determine the cost of the filter. Now, the Triad filter is unique in the fact that it does some, we'll talk about that filter a lot in just a minute, but it actually is way more sophisticated than most filters. Most filters just do one wavelength. a red filter, right, example, that might have, I don't know, quarter angstrom or something, half angstrom bandpass, will just do the red light and nothing else. Just let that small sliver of light through, but everything else is rejected. And so, yes, you can't even see most of the stuff that is actually passing through the optical assembly. That's why everything's dimmer. And imaging requires very narrow tolerances so that you don't see anything when you put an eyepiece in there and you use your eye. So,
yeah. Right. And there's a lot to take into consideration too. Like even the speed of the telescope can shift that bandpass, you know? So, you know, you really have to, I think this is an important episode because I do get these questions a lot and I do see people running into issues, and filters for astronomy can be very expensive. There's some sticker shock the first time you go out shopping for filters for imaging, and you realize that the best filters out there, I mean, like looking at the Triad is, you know, what has kind of been established as the top tier for multi-pass narrowband filters out there. I mean, you're looking at $1,000 plus for a 2-inch piece of glass. It's a very expensive filter, but it's exactly for the reason you were just describing. I mean, they're extremely narrow. The tolerances have to be, I mean, exact. They have to be very exact. And there's just no room for error. So
and these filters are very,
across four wavelengths.
I apologize.
Yeah, across four wavelengths on the same piece of glass. So it's very expensive to produce. And even if you're just buying one wavelength, if you just go buy a hydrogen alpha filter of the equal quality, I mean, it's going to be several hundred dollars for that filter. So there's a little bit of sticker shock the first time you go out shopping for quality filters. But I always tell people, and it sounds like a sales pitch, and it really isn't. It's just a way to avoid frustration. Is you don't want to put good glass. I mean, I'm sorry. You don't want to put bad glass in front of good glass. You know, you don't want to take this great telescope, and you just paid however many thousands of dollars for this phenomenal imaging scope, and then you put a filter on it that becomes the limiting factor in that imaging system, because whatever the worst piece of glass is in that system is going to be the issue. It's going to be the weakest link in the entire chain. That's right. And then is going to affect what actually makes it to your sensor. And so people go buy these very expensive telescopes, and then they buy a very cheap filter, and then they have all these bloated stars or these halos or all these issues in their final image, and they don't understand why. And it's like, well, filters are expensive for a reason, because you can produce these things cheaper. Absolutely. You can use cheaper glass. You can use cheaper coatings. You can definitely skimp on the process, or even just, you know, loosely post, you can post marketing that isn't necessarily representative of what actually is on the filter. You can do all these things, or just have quality control that doesn't match the end result that you're, you know, expecting. But all of those things lead to a user experience that can be very frustrating. Because even if you are buying something that's only $50 or $70, still a lot of money. And it's still something that you would expect your system to perform with. And it's not always the case. So generally, I try to tell people, like, buy the best, like the absolute best filter you can possibly buy. Because once you have it, you don't have to replace it. You're not going to have to, if you get a, you know, a 3 or 5 nanometer H-alpha filter, it's not something you're going to need to go buy again in 4 years or 5 years. You know, you're going to have this thing for a very, very long time. And 3 nanometers is 3 nanometers. It's not going to be different in 5 years. It's not going to be a new kind of 3 nanometers in 5 years. So you're good. Once you have it, you're good. You own it. And that problem is solved permanently for you.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is a question that you're uniquely qualified to answer for me, because I've been wondering about this. To build these filters is very expensive. These coatings, it's all about the coatings and the dielectrics that you put in there. They don't degrade over time.
We haven't seen any, because I mean, here's the thing: filters aren't exposed to any of the elements. They're tucked in a filter wheel all the time, or sitting in a case. Like, nobody ever leaves their filter sitting out. And if you do, yeah, you're going to have some issues over time.
So
if you leave it sitting out on a counter or, you know, outside, you're going to have some issues. But sitting in a filter wheel contained, sealed off from everything, including dust and all those things, like, no, the filter is going to last forever.
But the coatings can degrade over time if you don't take care of the filter itself, if you don't store it properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they're exposed to a lot of things, like even dew sits on them and constantly they're wet and then they dry, they're wet, then they dry. Yeah, you can have some issues. But, you know, of all of the problems we've ever seen regarding, you know, filters, and we've seen that with old filters, the old coatings. And I'm talking filters that are 10 years old. But anything new, and I can say this across pretty much all brands, even the less expensive brands, we don't see any issues where coatings, you know, they bought it a year ago and now the coating is halfway worn off or anything like that. Like that stuff just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I was curious because with professional filter wheels and filters that go into that, they do degrade if you're not really careful, especially in space telescopes. But then that they're out in a harsh environment. But
it's a little bit harsher.
Than
a telescope that's sitting in your house most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering about consumer grade filters if they
do. And I hear the air conditioning out in space isn't great. Neither is the heat.
a lot of temperature change. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
All right. Well. So do you want to let's talk a little bit about the different types and sizes that are out there? I guess within the astronomical filter category, of which I said most of them are interference filters. How do they split out in terms of type of filter?
Confusingly.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. So the place to start is with the size, like you just mentioned. Okay. You know, there's several different categories. There's light pollution filters, there's narrowband filters, there's broadband filters, which are color filters. And, you know, it's really challenging. There's a learning curve. There's no way around it. There's a learning curve with filters. And so that's just something that kind of has to be accepted so it can be addressed. But I really don't think that it has to be something that's in, you know, a hurdle that can't be overcome, even overcome very quickly, as long as, you know, it's taken seriously on the front end saying like, I need to understand what I'm getting into so that I don't make a mistake here, because those mistakes can be expensive. And so we've tried to put a lot of content out there on both OPT's Instagram, Facebook, also in the YouTube videos we do on OPT Telescopes YouTube. There are a lot of filter information there to make sure that people get the right thing the first time. But size is where it generally starts. And one of the mistakes I see people make is they go shopping for a filter, not really understanding their camera sensor. So somebody goes out and buys a camera. Like let's just throw a, for instance, you go buy a new ZWO camera and it's a $4,000 camera, and it can be the 533, which is less than $1,000. I'm just using this as an example because it's a very popular camera. That's a full frame camera. And so people then are thinking, you know, I want to get the most out of my camera. I'm going to buy a filter set for this. The problem is now they have some decisions to make, and there are going to be a few different sizes. You'll see 1.25, and then you'll see a couple of sizes in between that are measured in millimeters, all the way up to 50 millimeter. And then you'll see one that says 2-inch, right? Which is roughly 50, 48 millimeter filters you'll see with those. And so it's like, well, why is there a 2-inch, but also a 50 millimeter round? Shouldn't that be the same thing? And then there's, you know, 65 millimeters square and some are round. And then there's 50 millimeter round and 50 millimeter square. And so it gets a little bit convoluted. So let me break that down for just a second so that you don't end up buying the wrong thing. Because what I see is people buy a sensor and then they buy a filter that doesn't match that sensor for its size. And that's really what you have to be sure that you're covering. And so the goal in a filter is to make sure that the opening through the filter, you know, if that the filter itself, if held up to the sensor, would cover the entire thing. You wouldn't want to have, for instance, a sensor that is the size of your cell phone and then a filter that's the size of a penny, and it's only allowing that much light through to the sensor behind it, because obviously most of the sensor would not be illuminated. And while none of the sensors are actually that big that most people are buying, so that'd be a pretty extreme example, that's what ends up happening when people buy full frame cameras and then they buy 1.25 filters. And the reason people do that is because if you look at the 2-inch and you look at the 1.25 filter, there's a big price difference. And it's because there's not nearly the amount of coating on an 1.25 filter. It's just smaller, and a smaller filter is less expensive. So what I generally recommend to people is, if you don't know, the standard is 2-inch filters. And you have to look at your filter wheel, whichever filter wheel you're buying. The difference between the 50 millimeter round and the ones that say inch, whether it's inch and a quarter or 2 inch, is that the 2 inch filter or the inch filters are mounted. So they actually have a metal ring around them with threads that will thread directly into a filter wheel. So if you want a 2 inch, it's going to be the same size. It's going to cover a full frame sensor, but it will thread into the filter wheel. So if you know that your filter wheel has threads, then you can buy the ones that say 2 inch and it'll cover your full frame sensor. If it doesn't, if it just has the opening that a filter drops into, and then they have these little washers that hold it down, these little plastic washers that hold it down, that's where you would get the 50 millimeter round. So if your filter wheel does not say threaded, you want to get the filters that use the millimeters instead of the inches designations.
That's great. I'm glad you did that. That was that's a good piece of advice. We're going to talk about filter wheels, I think, a little bit more in just a minute. So because you need a way to hold those filters in your optical train, and that's one way you do it. Right. Okay. What about the different types? There's types of filters. You want to talk about that now?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the biggest one that I think people are fighting, and we talk about this problem all the time, is light pollution. You know, so that's the one that, you know, you see on both sides, monochrome cameras and color cameras. You see people using light pollution filters for different reasons now. But especially with color cameras, it's generally the first thing people come looking for is a good light pollution filter. And there are so many brands that do it very, very well. Universal Astro is probably the best bang for the buck for light pollution filter, especially if you have a Canon camera, be an APS-C, so the size down from full frame. There's one that's made to clip into the Canon cameras with that, and it clips right in, and it's designed specifically for that, to block out light pollution, but to still allow the band passes to come through from space so that you don't get as much noise in the images. Noise meaning just things you didn't intend, like street lamps and other stuff coming through in your image. But there are so many great brands. I mean, Astronomique has a phenomenal filter. Optolong does this very, very well, all the way up to, you know, the top end, which would be Radian, you know, the Triad Ultra filters, which are, you know, hands down the best for light pollution prevention in images, because they're just the narrowest. There's nothing that even compares. It's not even close. I mean, you're talking about true narrowband, 3 and 4 nanometers, but it's also a multiple of the price of the others. A lot of these filters are $150, whereas the Radian at the top end is going to be, you know, $1,000 plus. So it's a drastic difference. And if you just need a little bit of light pollution help, then I'd say start with something like the Universal Astro and kind of, you know, get your feet wet with it and test it out and see if it's enough. It might be enough if you're not in an area with tons of light pollution. The Radian we generally recommend if you know, like, all right, you live in a city, you're in Dallas, Texas, and you've got the airport next door and all that, or a stadium that's got light shining into your backyard. It's like, well, you need to skip all the other ones and go straight to something like the Radian Triad Ultra, because otherwise you're just going to have tons of problems, you know?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but a light pollution filter and nothing else, if that's all you used was a light pollution filter, like this Universal Astro one, which by the way is pretty reasonable, it will reduce stray light and cut down on sky glow, sky background quite a bit in your images and improve some contrast. Is that the effect of a light pollution filter and nothing else? If that's all you had?
That's all it's designed to do. People have used the other filters for things like luminance filters, especially the Triad gets used as a luminance filter a lot for monochrome cameras. Because with color imaging, you use red, green, blue, and to get each color. And then you have a luminance filter, which allows red, green, and blue to pass together, which give you your brightness values, right? So you get all your detail and the brightness values from that. And people do the same thing with narrowband imaging. They have hydrogen, sulfur, and oxygen, and they channel combine each one as an independent color. So you could do like Hubble palette and get red, green, and blue out of that. And then, you know, in combining that, they will look for a brightness value. And that's where a filter that has all three of those channels together, like the triad, but still narrow so that your signal is still very strong, makes a lot of sense. It essentially becomes a luminance filter for narrowband imaging. And a lot of people are using it that way.
That's really, yeah, that's, it's an amazing filter. It really is. Well, let's dive into it just a little bit then. There are, you kind of have to match your filter to the object that you're photographing, right? Or you're imaging, correct? So I say photograph, it just conjures up images of film. But so when you're imaging, which is what you tend to do with CCDs and CMOS detectors, certain filters work better for certain objects, right? How do you match that up? Like if I, you know, explain a little bit about, you know, what you're imaging versus what kind of filter you might need.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, it's really all of the stuff we're talking about right now applies mostly to what are called emission nebulae. And that's where you're going to see like ionized hydrogen and things that are kind of producing their own light. And that light is measured at a very specific wavelength, hydrogen alpha, which you could probably dig into a lot better than I can on the professional side, Tony. But essentially, you know, these are all the big, pretty nebula that you see in all these photos. So like the North America, the Pelican, you know, Orion Nebula, Horsehead, on and on and on, Rosette, you know, all the ones that are super famous that you see, those are going to be, most of which are going to be the emission nebula. And these are the ones that you have the advantage of using these types of filters because they're looking specifically for hydrogen, oxygen, and sulfur. You can basically cheat by putting that filter in and cutting out all the streetlights and things that aren't putting off those exact wavelengths, but the nebulae behind them are. So you get all the signal from the nebulae, but you don't get the street lamp. That's where the filters that we're talking about really come in handy. Galaxies and reflection nebulae, not the same thing. It's much more challenging. You really need dark skies to do those well.
Yeah, unless those galaxies or whatever emit in those wavelength ranges.
Right.
The reason these are
and
so
you can
great
get away with it, yeah.
Yeah, you can do it. Nebulae actually generate light from oxygen, from nitrogen, from hydrogen, and from all these different elements that are within the nebula creating stars. They make them brighter in those particular wavelengths because they're shining at those wavelengths. That's why they're called emission nebula. So you want to match the filter bandpass with whatever it is you're looking at that's emitting in those wavelengths the strongest. Now, a galaxy does have a broad spectrum, which it radiates. It goes anywhere from gamma rays from black holes all the way down to infrared and radio wavelengths. So what you view the galaxy in will depend on what filter you use and what you will see. One of the most remarkable pictures of the Andromeda Galaxy was taken by the Spitzer Space Telescope in purely infrared light. And it shows all of the star-forming regions in these little arcs and bands across the spiral arms where the stars are being born and nothing else. And it's really awesome.
That is a beautiful image.
Yeah. So, but can't do that from the ground because it's in the infrared. So, you match your filter with what you're looking at in that way. What is this object I'm looking at emitting at in the brightest? And the beauty of the triad filter is it's been tuned specifically for these emission nebulae, and it does it in all these different wavelengths. It's really hard. And Dustin's told me stories about what OPT went through to get the coatings in such a way that they got the band passes they were after and the widths of those band passes. The wavelengths they were after and the band passes together. Was a very hard feat. I've never heard of anybody else doing it, filter manufacturers. So this is really the only, I think it's the only place you can get a filter like this. In the professional world, you can tune your filter, but even then you can only tune it over a certain wavelength range. Like I worked on a filter that did tune among the helium one bands for the sun, but you turned a knob and you had these really complicated variable retarders that change their index of refraction by current that was flowing through them. You could tune along a certain wavelength range. Very expensive, very specialized. These are not tunable, but in a way they kind of are. You've got four wavelengths. I keep saying three because it's a triad. Why do you call it the triad if it's got four wavelengths?
Well, the first one, so it evolved. That's why. The first one had three. Yeah, the first one had three, but we added H beta.
So now it's quad.
Right. It is.
Sound is cool.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So it's still the triad. And it was the first thing that Radian produced. Honestly, it was a Hail Mary project where we were just like, we want this to exist, but it's probably not gonna work. But then we just got, you know, super invested in the project, and you start getting little hints that, well, will this? Maybe. And then, you know, got the first one done and it worked. And we were like, well, we got to push it even further. And that's where the Triad Ultra came from.
Okay, well, let's talk a little. So the Triad is absolutely something you should consider putting in your kit bag. But what about the other filters, just the standard RGB filter sets? Are mm-hmm. there kits available or sets available that you would recommend for people to get? These are just your basic RGBs?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would. Where this really comes in handy is that there's a big difference between a color camera and a monochrome camera. And that probably would justify its own episode again. I know we did one over a year ago, mm-hmm. But we probably should update that because there's so many cameras that have been released recently. So many phenomenal cameras. I feel like the last year has been just so game changing for the camera world. But so color cameras, just the quick, we're riding up the elevator, spill it all now before we get to the top of the building pitch on color versus mono, is that color cameras already have the filters attached to the sensor itself. So every photo site, which is essentially the pixels, every pixel has its own filter in front of it. So before light ever hits the sensor, it has to pass through a filter. And so the way that you get color is that they have those filters in a pattern. Most of the time that pattern is RGGB, repeating over and over across all of the entire sensor. So red, green, green, blue, which means that each pixel on the camera can only see one color. It can only, if it's covered in a green pixel or if it's covered in a green filter, that pixel can never see red. It can never see blue. It can only see green. So if it goes RGGB, then you think about it, that sensor, half of that sensor is dedicated only to green light, which is phenomenal for just about all terrestrial shooting. And the sense that, as you mentioned, our eyes are most attuned to green as a color. But in space, it's not the color you see the most of. You know, and so having half of your sensor dedicated to green when you're trying to shoot hydrogen alpha, which is red, is not the best thing. It means you're going to give up a lot of light if you're trying to isolate hydrogen. So you put another filter over that color camera that's only going to allow red light to pass through, but only 1/4 of your pixels are dedicated to capturing red light. There's a lot of interpolation that has to happen, a lot of guessing by the sensor of where the rest of the red light is, because 75% of the sensor can't see it. And so that becomes a problem, you know, and you're just cutting out too much light. So what a lot of people do instead, and I want to throw a really quick disclaimer here. Listen, a lot of the best images in the world, including one that I just saw Bray Falls post, who is one of the best astrophotographers out there. If you haven't seen his stuff, go check him out on Instagram or really anywhere, TikTok, Bray Falls. But he just posted one that was taken with a stock Canon camera. And it's one of the best images I've ever seen of the Orion and Horsehead. So the Orion Nebula and Horsehead Nebula. And you can do this stuff with a color camera. You absolutely can. You're just going to need dark skies and a lot of patience. But, you know, with monochrome cameras, you don't have that problem. The whole sensor, none of the sensor has any filters over any of the photo sites. So instead, what you do is you just get big filters that allow you to tell the camera which type of light that you're collecting, you know, or even just tell yourself. So all of the light passes through and you're going to put a red filter over the whole thing. Then you know everything it registers right now is red. And so once you're combining all those images at the end, you know everything I shot with that red filter in front of it was red light. Nothing else could pass through. Then you do the same with green, then the same with blue. You put them all on top of each other. Now you have a full color image. And people ask me, they're like, well, isn't that fake? Won't the color be fake? Because you're shooting them all separately. The color is actually more accurate that way than it is by shooting it with a color camera. And the reason is that interpolation, like I was just saying a minute ago, if only half of the pixels can see, you know, anything other than green, it has to guess and fill in the gaps in between at what was red and blue. Same with, you know, green for the red pixels and blue for the red pixels. It has to guess. And with monochrome cameras, there's no guessing. It's just, if it came through with this filter, it means it was only green. Nothing else could pass through. It means it was only red. So when you combine those images, you're combining them very precisely. So it's not that people are, when you see these monochrome images, it's not that they're taking black and white photos and then going into Photoshop and just adding colors and making it whatever they want. It's, you know, when they combine those images and they get a true color image, that is an actual representation of those colors in space.
The filters that are used in this context, like if you took a series of filters of the of images of the Orion Nebula all in red, and then did the same sequence of images all in green and then all in blue, the nature of those filters, but they tend to have a broader bandpass than, say, the Triad might have. So they tend to be less expensive. So you can get a better deal on these. They're still, you know, you want to pay attention to who's manufacturing these and the coatings and the glass that they use, but they tend to be a little bit less expensive. And we're going to talk about filter wheels, I think, in a bit here, but they also really lend themselves well to having an easy way to change filters in and out of the image that you're taking or the object that you're taking, so you can get different wavelengths. So these are pretty good general purpose filters, though. You can use these on all kinds of things. I've seen people get color, such as it is, out of the moon using RGB filters. There are, you know, some of it's like a lot of artistic license on this, I've seen. But you can get some cool stuff. You can use these on just about any object that's out there, planets, the galaxies, nebulae, all kinds of things. So they're good. They're a good investment to have, just because, especially if you're imaging, because they're good. They're just such a all around thing you're going to use a lot. Should we talk a little bit about filter wheels now? Having a filter wheel in your repertoire can make your life a lot easier, right?
Yeah, let's dive into it. Filter wheel basics. The first thing you're going to come across is that just about all brands that make cameras make filter wheels for their cameras in order to make it easy for attachment. I haven't seen any filter wheels that I would say just stay away from. Most companies are doing a very good job at producing their filter wheels. So, you know, they really only have one function, which is to rotate to whichever filter it is that you're trying to isolate at the moment. So software packages are all going to have that capability to say, go to filter two, and filter two, you know, you're going to have a specific order that you put your filters in. Like for me, I always use 7 position filter wheels, and it always goes the same every time. It's L, R, G, B, H, A, S, 2, O, 3. And I do that just because, you know, I keep S, 2 in the middle just so that it goes 2, 3 and I can remember it. because I have a lot of different filter wheels and it's easy to remember that way. But people have a lot of different, you know, ways that they put those in, and it really doesn't matter. As long as you know what it is, you can say, go to filter 5. For me, filter 5 would always be HA, so I know where I'm at. But filter wheels in general, that's the only function that they really serve, is to make sure that you're on the correct filter when you need to be. And so they're all pretty easy to load. They're all really easy to set up. They're easy to connect. I wouldn't say that you have to choose a specific brand. Choose the brand that you're comfortable with already, and you're more than likely going to be happy with the quality of their wheel, because most companies are doing a very good job with it. Now, as far as the sizes of the wheels, one thing to take into consideration is almost everybody makes a 5 position, and almost everybody makes a 7 plus position. So 7, 8, or 9 position wheel. And that's really important because you have to decide what type of shooting you're going to be doing. If you get a 5 position wheel, you're going to have to make some decisions on what you're going to leave out. You know, with a 7 position or an 8 position, you get a little bit more freedom to add narrowband or to add, you know, additional filters, like maybe even a dark filter so that you can shoot darks and things like that. With 5, it really only leaves you the room to do either or, which is either a full narrowband set or a full color set, and then one narrowband filter. So what a lot of people do with 5 position is they go LRGB, so they get full color, and then they add one narrowband filter, which is almost always hydrogen alpha, and that's their 5th, right? but you can't add the S2 and O3 because you're just out of positions. The benefit of the 5 position is it's smaller, so you don't have this big filter wheel hanging off your system, you know, and it's also lighter. The 7 position is a lot more common because then you can add those extra 2 filters in and you have the freedom to shoot whatever you want, whenever you want. So you can do the, you know, LRGB, HA, S2, O3, and then when the moon's out, you switch to narrowband and you're going to shoot all your narrowband. And then when the moon's gone, you switch to your color and you get all your LRGB. And so that's what you see most commonly, but you really have to decide what's important on your system. Do you want it to be smaller, less expensive? Then go with the 5 position. If you, and you know you're never going to shoot oxygen or sulfur, then definitely stay with the 5 position. It doesn't matter. But the 7 position is more about like, hey, I'm going to spend a little extra money. It's going to be a little bigger on my system, but I want that long-term freedom to be able to shoot whatever it is I want.
What about the feature set for these filter wheels? Are they all pretty much the same? Like, do they all let you control things by software, for example, or do you have to turn a knob to get to the different filter positions? Are they all pretty much the same in that regard, or do they vary widely?
Yeah, so there are still a few manual. So the designation is electronic versus manual. The manual filter wheels mean you have to be out there with the scope and manually turn the wheel to a position. Electronic means that it's software driven. So software is going to turn it for you via a motor.
Is there a significant price difference?
I won't say significant. Filter wheels aren't the expensive piece of a system, sure, generally. You know, everything else is going to be much more expensive than the filter wheel itself. So most people, I'd say 99 people out of 100 anymore are going with electronic. And, you know, I almost never see the other ones move compared to, you know, the electronic wheels fly. People are buying wheels all the time for their systems. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's really important to decide what it is you're going to be shooting and really think about that on the front end. Because even the examples I just said, those are not the only setups you can have. I didn't even mention nitrogen. We haven't mentioned nitrogen this entire time. Some people only want to shoot planetary nebulae. And if that's the case, you're probably going to want a nitrogen filter or at minimum a wider band pass of hydrogen, because hydrogen and nitrogen are right next to each other. So if you go with a little bit wider, instead of like a 3 nanometer hydrogen alpha filter, instead you get a 5 nanometer. Now you're getting hydrogen and nitrogen in the same band pass. But you can also just get a nitrogen filter separate and keep it really narrow as well. So you've got some decisions to make on the front end to decide, like, what do I want to shoot? What would be the goal? What will I be happiest with if I achieve it?
Well, with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about solar filters. Let's say a few words about that, because that requires a very specialized rig. And you've seen solar telescopes that are built by Lunt and Daystar and others. These filters typically use, they're typically tuned to let through hydrogen alpha from the sun, H alpha light, which is 6562, I believe, angstroms. And you, there are two main kinds of solar filters that you can have. One of them is the what I call white light filters, and they're usually a big Mylar disc, sometimes made of glass, that sit over your optical tube assembly and block out like 95% of the photons from the sun and let in some small percentage through the optical tube assembly. It's a filter, but mostly it's a illumination filter, because it just blocks, it keeps you from blinding yourself from looking directly into an optical tube at the sun, which you never want to do without this filter in place. And that's one kind of filter, and it lets most of the visible light wavelengths through, and you end up with a disc image of the sun in white light. You can see sunspots with it, and in some cases you might see a prominence, but probably not. And you can see whatever features and activities on the disc of the sun. That's one type. And another type is usually, it's called an Edelon filter. This is a complicated interference filter that has layers on it, and how many layers you have depends on your specific use. But the main manufacturers that are of solar filters that I've seen tend to have 2 discs, sometimes 3, of Edelon stacking that give you, and these are, the quality of these filters is generally characterized by the wavelength bandpass. They're half angstrom, 3/4 angstrom, a quarter angstrom, those are the best. And the thinner the bandpass, the tighter that bandpass, the more contrast and detail you're going to see on the surface of the sun. So you can see granularity, in fact, if you have a really good high-quality double-stacked filter. These are where they have more than one etalon in front of the other. You get even narrower bandpasses. You get less light, but, you know, photons aren't a problem when looking at the sun, so you really you really don't care. But
yeah, that's not the issue. Detail.
Yeah, you want to see that contrast. You want to be able to see filaments on the disk, prominence on the limb, granularity if you can get it in the photosphere. All of that stuff is just stunning. And as you can imagine, they're not cheap. So, but that's another kind of solar. That's another kind of very special purpose filter. It's not going to work anywhere else. Pointed at the moon, you're not going to see anything,
you know,
things like that. So I just wanted to say a little bit of word about solar observing, because those are also filters. You really can't do it without it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a problem you're never going to hear anybody describe. Like, oh, I was looking at the sun and I couldn't get enough photons.
It's my favorite kind. I have a PST that I bought way back in 2007. This is before Mead bought them, I guess, from Coronado. It's a 40 millimeter thing. And I use my little Star Adventure mount for this. And I just love it. It's such a fun time. It's like a 3/4 angstrom. So I don't get a lot of, contrast with it, but I get enough, and it's got a knob on it, and that knob is a tunable filter. It lets you move those discs back and forth so that you can center it, because it's a little bit temperature sensitive, back on the H alpha line. And so that little knob helps you. It's a example of a tunable filter. It's not really very tunable. It just moves those etalons back and forth just a little bit, those layers, so that you can see center it a little bit, because they do drift. So,
those little scopes are awesome, man. The PSTs, personal solar telescopes.
I love mine. Those things are amazing. I love mine. Yeah. It's visual only. Because of the eye relief, on these old ones was really funky, and I had to, have to hold my head just right to be able to see it. The new ones, I don't think that's a problem. Like the, what do they have? So what are they called now? Solar Max? What's the one?
Coronado's got some great, great solar scopes, and Lunt as well. Lunt has always keep raising the bar.
They're the one.
What's that?
Those. I want that.
Yeah.
I want a Lunt.
Lunt solar telescopes are incredible. We just got one in that, I've been looking at, I'm like, I've got a friend of mine that's actually purchasing it, but the whole time I'm like, oh man, if you don't buy it, I'm okay with that. Cause I might just keep it. It's like a big 130 Lunt, and they do such a good job for imaging solar telescopes too. And the quality is just so phenomenal. So yeah, there are a lot of great solar options out there. Yeah,
that's on my wish list is one of those. I'd love to get my hands
on
those telescopes, but it's a part of the hobby that I think is gaining in popularity, because while these are expensive, they're not unaffordable. They are definitely within reasonable price ranges, and the kinds of views you get of the sun are just
You can do it during the day, right? And that's a big thing for people with families, or that have to be in bed early. So it's nice being able to do it during the day, and also the sun changes all day every day. So you can go out at early and see one thing, and go out the same day later that afternoon and see something new and get different images the same day. So. Which isn't necessarily the case with deep space astrophotography. So, yeah, it's a completely different way to enjoy the hobby.
Okay, and I guess I'd like to fade out this episode with a quick advice on cleaning filters, because I think you need to be – what do you need to worry about when you want to clean filters? To me, this is a kind of a big topic, because you could ruin it if you do them wrong, right? So
you can definitely damage filters. And so, we sell cleaning solutions for telescopes. We actually sell entire kits on our website, optcorp.com. You'll see, on the homepage, there's a banner for it, because this time of year, especially, people start, going through their stuff, getting it ready, because, the horse head's out now. And it's going to be out for the next month and a half, 2 months. It's that time of year. So people get this stuff out, but usually what people start with is just these little blower kits. And we sell like the kit that, I think makes the most sense. We sell what's called a deluxe telescope maintenance bundle, but that comes with everything. And it, like I said, it starts with you know, the thing that can damage the filters or the telescope the least, which is like these air compression little squeeze tools. And it's got a small one and a larger one so that you can blow the dust off of it without actually touching the filter, because those coatings can be very sensitive and very fragile. So you really don't want to touch them if you don't have to, ever. Same thing on mirrors, same thing on lenses. I've seen people scratch their telescopes thinking, oh, well, I was just going to barely wipe off this, you know, grain of sand that was on there. And then they scratch the mirror. So you really want to be careful and just use air if you can without having to touch it. And then if not, we do sell cleaning solutions for these things. But what I would say is just always be 1,000 times more careful and more gentle than you think you need to be. And you'll be happy that you are, because your filters, your telescope optics, all that stuff will still work and still perform for you. Just don't get in there and be aggressive with filters or telescope optics ever. Because, you know, you'll be calling us the next day saying, oh, I need a new one.
Yeah. It's especially true with filters. It's true with all optical components for sure. But the dielectric coatings on these things are very, very fragile. And they are often very thin, sometimes only a few atoms thick. So you really need to not touch it at all if you can get away with it. I've seen in professional observatories, the filter wheels would be kind of coated in dust, and mm-hmm. while, and they don't really affect the performance, then it basically just means you got to expose for slightly longer in your images, but they leave right. them alone. You know, they, yeah. they really, you could see a coating of dust as long as it's laminar. It's, they basically, I'm not suggesting you do this with yours, but that's, you know, that's how important it is to just leave yep. these filters be. If you can. And it's especially important when you go to clean them to be, like Dustin said, try not to touch them in any way at all. But that is true of anything. The coatings on refractors and corrector plates, all of that stuff can be, is, you know, you could just see a big gash going through it sometimes where someone's wiped a sand grain across it. So you want to always try not to touch it if you can.
Right, exactly. Yeah, always do less on that front than, you know, do the least amount you possibly can on that front. Don't get in there and really try to polish yeah,
that,
a filter.
That 20 inch I have has got a coating of dust on it, and I'm still observing just fine. It comes with a shroud around the tube to kind of minimize this, but you're not going to stop it entirely. And as long as, and I'm going to let that, you know, I'm going to clean it soon, but I'm going to, you know, with distilled water and basically just pouring it over the top. But we should have an episode on this at some point. But with filters, I just want to emphasize the fragility and the delicacy of those coatings.
Yeah, and that's why those kits make sense. You know, they come with, we probably ordered in 100 different cloths trying to find the one that had the least potential to scratch an optic. So it comes with one of those cloths, which actually the one we found, and we went through everything, but the one we found was actually used for two things. It was scientific purposes, and then also, which was really strange to me, upper end guitar cleaning. When people are getting, like, you know, the collector's guitars, you know, for museums and things, that's what they use. And so we got those cloths in. And then we got these really, really fine brushes to where if you touch the ends of it, they just completely fold. There's almost no strength to the brush at all, but it allows you to wipe off things without putting any pressure at all on the system, which is really good. And then we have a cleaning solution that's in those kits as well. But most of the time people it's enough to just use the little hand compressed air thing and just blow off the dust on the system and leave it alone. And that's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. That's plenty good. Okay. Well, good. I hope this helped you understand filters a little bit. Before I close out this episode, I want to let you guys know that when Dustin and I are on these episodes and you're listening to us talk about products, one of the things I'm doing is I'm working with Drew on this, and I'm taking these episodes and I'm cutting them into segments that are capturing the video, and I'm showing, and along as we're talking about whatever it is it happens to be, the triad filter, this cleaning kit, whatever it is, I put the pictures of it on the video so you know exactly what we're talking about that's on the website. And I'm putting links in the description box of the videos where you can go see them for yourself. So if you're listening to this solely on audio on Spotify or iTunes or wherever you're getting your podcast from, know that these videos exist. They're coming out a little bit after the fact because it takes me longer to produce these. But the episode comes out, and then I try and provide the videos not too long after that. So I just wanted to make you aware that they're there. And if you want to see specific questions answered on this podcast, reach out to me and I'll be happy to talk with you about, you know, including that in an episode or whatever it is. So so take a look for those videos as well. And they're an easy way for you to get access to stuff on OPT Tells OPTCorp.com. But they also have a good search engine, so you can just do the search as well. So both ways, so you can get access to this stuff. Okay. Well, Dustin, I like this episode. This was fun for me because I like talking about, I like to get nerdy about this stuff. So yeah, this was fun.
Okay. Yeah. All right, they guys. Always are.
Yeah. I hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving. And on behalf of Dustin Gibson, I'm Tony Darnell. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up.
Space Junk is produced by Deep Astronomy and sponsored by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California. Please visit our website at spacejunkpodcast.com. Also, please send any questions and comments or ideas for new episodes to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.